I declare bankruptcy!
I congratulate you on your imagination, but this is a court of space law, not a theater.
Fax mentis incendium gloria calpum etc etc memo bis punitor delicatum. It's all there, black and white, clear as crystal.
How is this a fair trial? Our lawyer is a Morty.
It's not fair. You have no rights, and he's not a lawyer. We just keep him here because he's fun. Look at him go.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 147. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am great, Thomas. How are you?
Good. I'm looking forward to you speaking with Lucian Greaves of the Satanic Temple today. And boy, I don't think we have any announcements or anything. So tell you what, why don't we get over to it?
Yeah, I can't wait.
And today we're joined by Lucian Greaves of the Satanic Temple. And as listeners will know, this is a sort of a two-parter because I spoke to Jex Blackmore. But in this interview, hopefully we can talk more about this really interesting Missouri abortion case. But Lucian, how are you doing today?
Not bad. How are you doing?
Doing great. Really happy to have you on the show. And we've referenced the Satanic Temple an awful lot on the show because of the good work you guys do. And it's really fun to finally talk to you. It's amazing how much, you know, how much law. Do you feel like you're a lawyer? Do you feel like you have a lot of legal experience from the work that you guys have done?
No. People ask me that all the time. They ask me if I went to law school or what other legal training I have. I really have none. We have these issues that are important to us, and we have these grievances that we feel are legitimate, and then it's up to the lawyers to really hash it out. So,
interesting.
Sorry if I disappoint when it comes to parsing out some of the legal minutiae, but I'm more the kind of Captain Kirk character who screams charge, and then we have our lawyer Spock characters who try to work out the logistics while we're running face first into battle.
Yeah, I'm the red shirt of the show.
You did go to the expendable.
Yeah, exactly. You did go to the only university that matters, though. So that's important that we get that.
So I'm told. Yeah.
Did you go to Trump University? What is he talking about?
Yep, the only one that matters today.
No, Lucian is a Harvard grad, So that's why we agreed to have him on the show.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. That's the only people we interview. Yeah, no, fascinating. Yeah. That's interesting, though. So it's what gave you the idea then to start doing this? Because I know you are trying to point out a lot of the ways that the law favors Christianity, or at least politicians and other people try to use the law to favor one religion over others. Is there something that sparked that doesn't really come from a legal background?
The affinity for Satanism and this notion that that religious liberty is for all. We had a lot of projects in mind starting this up, and reproductive rights was one of them. But what really gave us a boost and really encouraged us to move ahead full throttle further was actually the Hobby Lobby ruling. Mm-hmm. And now when we hear people giving the old arguments from around the 70s and 80s, because this has been litigated before, the idea that our religion doesn't compel a woman to get an abortion, therefore the religious claim to protect abortion is illegitimate, I think just ignores the shift in the landscape regarding religious freedom following rulings like Hobby Lobby. because previously, whereas you may have been able to say, and I think there were some questionable rulings that would have given precedent in our favor anyways before in this, in, you know, the 70s, 80s, and 90s, that there's nothing that compels the abortion. You know, what compels Hobby Lobby to refuse to pay for healthcare benefits that have contraceptives involved in the package? There's no direct scriptural lineage towards that way of thinking. It's just a religious claim being attached to a religion without any kind of scriptural basis, any kind of basis in regular practice. So it really kind of opened the door for a whole new interpretation of freedom of conscience and deeply held belief. And I think it's kind of ludicrous to say now, when we put forward this idea that our tenet that holds that the body is inviolable, subject to one's own will alone, it is too vague to be tied to our call for exemptions on abortion restrictions, is a little ludicrous in that light. So, and some other legal experts and commentators following our Supreme Court hearing in Missouri have made that connection to Hobby Lobby also. So hopefully in the course of the ruling, the judges consider that as well.
So, Lucian, there's so much I want to drill down on in terms of what you've just said. I really want to talk about what, from your perspective, constitutes a religious belief, because I think that's a super interesting question that gets to kind of the heart of exploring the logic of the Supreme Court's decision or illogic of the Hobby Lobby decision. But let's, in order to do that, I'm going to talk about the specific Missouri case, and then let me know if you think I've gotten something wrong in the summary here, and then, you know, we'll sort of do the application of the principle that you just talked about to the case. So my understanding is that the current Missouri law that the petitioner Mary Doe, who is affiliated and a member of the Satanic Temple, is challenging, really does three things if you are a woman seeking to have a first trimester abortion in Missouri. So number one, it imposes a 72-hour, three-day waiting period. Number two, it requires that the woman sit there while the abortion provider read and hand her state-mandated and state-sponsored religious nonsense that includes stuff like a statement that says the life of each human being begins at conception. Abortion will terminate the life of a separate, unique, living human being. And then number three has a provision that's had some controversy at oral argument. Here's what the law says. The law says that the state shall provide the woman with the opportunity to view at least 72 hours prior to the abortion an active ultrasound of the unborn child and hear the heartbeat of the unborn child if the heartbeat is audible. And that particular phrasing of the law is something that duplicates model legislation that's been proposed by pro-lifers in Virginia and elsewhere that previously has always been thought of as being, even though it says provide with the opportunity, in order to provide a woman with the opportunity to view the ultrasound, previous laws have interpreted this in other states as the state has to conduct the ultrasound, right? Medically unnecessary, mandatory ultrasound. And then they give the woman the opportunity to view the outcome. That didn't happen in this case. Or, I've raised five or six different issues. But first, I mean, did I get the case right? Is there anything you'd like to add in terms of?
Right. And that was the shocker of our Supreme Court hearing, was when the Attorney General conceded that he interpreted the law to mean that a woman only needed to have the opportunity presented to have the ultrasound, but she could refuse it. And as you said, it's been interpreted as mandatory previously that the ultrasound take place. Mm-hmm. And that was the interpretation of Planned Parenthood and other institutions that are against these abortion restrictions. That's generally been where people thought the law was. So it was in itself, before any ruling came down, simply to have the Attorney General of the state on record conceding what was believed to be mandatory ultrasounds and saying that they were strictly optional So that caught the attention of the press as well, and has been viewed as a victory already in advance of the ruling coming out.
Oh, that's interesting.
So well, that's
can I ask? I want to ask Andrew then.
That's encouraging.
Yeah, no, absolutely, that's awesome. But I want to know from our legal expert then, Andrew, does that commit them to anything? Like, if they make that argument, are they then committed to the position that yes, you can turn down these ultrasounds, or are they able to say like, nah, he just got it wrong or something like that? Can they go back on that?
So I think the best way for me to answer that is to ask a follow-up to Lucian.
Perfect.
My understanding is that the office of the Missouri Attorney General, the day after your oral arguments before the Supreme Court, in this case, which were a couple of weeks ago, issued a formal memorandum saying that they were going to interpret the statute in this fashion going forward. Is that right?
That I don't know. If that's the case, that's something that escaped my attention. Jex would probably have a better idea, but I hope so. That would also be a surprise to me. But if they're committed to conceding that and conceding it defensively, I hope that bodes well for how seriously they're taking our case also.
Yeah, well, and that would lead to the follow-up question, which is, I don't know if you have heard from Planned Parenthood in Missouri or other abortion providers as to whether they've changed their practice.
No, I haven't heard anything about that. We haven't had any formal discussions or meetings with Planned Parenthood. I know there was a time where some of the right-wing Christian press, pro-life press, were really promoting this idea that Satanists and Planned Parenthood were colluding on all of this, but it's just not the case. We're not working against each other, and we're not working with each other. There's no sense of competition. We have overlapping interests, but there isn't any formal merging of powers here.
Well, and so then to kind of put it together, The government is not necessarily bound by the position that their lawyer takes at oral argument. And we have talked about that with respect to, you know, some of the Trump executive orders and the like. But nevertheless, it certainly would have what you would do is in future litigation. So if a provider declines to require these medically unnecessary ultrasound procedures based on their interpretation of the law in the light of the concession made at oral argument by the state of Missouri, then they would be able to rely on a judicial admission. They would be able to say, hey, look, you know, the Office of the Attorney General said in open court, the law doesn't require us to do this, so we're not doing that. And that would be a defense to being charged under the law as having violated the legal standards. But it's not, it absent more, it doesn't necessarily indicate that there would still be legal room. But I mean I certainly agree with Lucian that that in a way that's already a victory, and I would love to see. We'll follow up so as not to make sure that that there are no charges of collusion. We'll follow up independently and see what medical providers in Missouri are doing. I think additionally, Lucian, I think you're exactly right that when I look at the briefs that were filed in this case and I think about the strengths and weaknesses of the lawsuit, I certainly think that the being required to undergo the ultrasound is the if that fact is in evidence, then it makes the state's response, which focused almost entirely on an act omission distinction, right? Said, if you take away the medically unnecessary ultrasound, then the state's position is we're not requiring anybody to do anything. So therefore, we cannot be infringing upon the free exercise, sincerely held religious beliefs of any individual. That's a weird, it's an odd argument to make, but let me kind of tackle it at the top level first, which is assume that the state's correct and assume that going forward, this law eliminates that third provision, gives you the choice of whether you want the ultrasound or not, and just imposes the 72-hour waiting period, the member, you know, a member of the staff has to read some religious nonsense at you. Would you argue that that still constitutes an infringement upon the sincerely held satanic religious beliefs of Mary Doe?
Right. Well, yes. And actually, that was the thrust of the case. And when you ordered your summary, it might seem a little bit of hair splitting, but I would have changed the order. You mentioned the 72-hour waiting period first, then the state mandated materials that need to be read by some staffer or whatever. But the 72-hour waiting period is supposed to be justified by the state mandated materials in written form. The materials that state that life begins at conception and abortion will terminate the life of a distinct individual human being. The idea is that a woman will take these materials home that state this what we believe to be religious propaganda, and consider them for 72 hours. Now, keep in mind, she's not able to simply this material online. She needs to travel to the clinic, and in a place where there's one clinic, you know, that can be a prohibitive bit of travel to go one day, then come back 3 days later to actually have the procedure done. And it's really just meant to make the procedure difficult to get, to make it prohibitive for women to try to make less abortions happen, regardless of what the circumstances are and surrounding somebody's trying to obtain it, which I think is horrible. That's awful. But because the 72-hour waiting period is tied in with this religious propaganda, we think we can be exempted from that by the very fact that we don't agree with these positions. Again, we interpret our own tenet that the body is inviolable, subject to one's own will alone, along with where we feel the science is at on fetal development, to claim that the non-viable fetus, fetal tissue that can't survive outside of the woman's body, is tissue belonging to the woman. And it's her choice as to what becomes of it, whether she carries it to term or not. And we even think the point that abortion will terminate the life of an individual and distinct human being is an arguable point as well. Well, the point that life begins at conception is arguable because that's really a philosophical question. At what point does life begin? But it's not as though the biological matter just springs into life. It's not like you have inanimate material that's brought to life by this kind of combination. You know, there's no point where you can really say a distinct beginning of life happened. And now you have the some of the pro-life faction saying, well, unique DNA defines life. Well, it really doesn't. Tumors have unique DNA. Fetuses, even brought to term, they can have unique genetic mapping that up to the point where it's not able to exist outside the womb or before 20 weeks can branch off and become twins. It's more of a genetic map than anything else. When we look at personhood, we look at higher cognitive functions. We look at the ability to perceive, to feel, that type of thing. Not just registering sensation, but actual perception. Mm-hmm. As I said, higher cognitive function. But anyways, that's a very kind of philosophical debate. We think it falls very much within the purview of religious discussion. And if the state cannot elevate those arguments made in the state mandated material to scientific absolutes universally agreed upon, at least universal within reason, then it has to fall within religious discussion and religious exemption. And we feel that higher burden is on them, and that we are fully able to be exempted from these things on a religious claim. And there again, I would have to refer back to Hobby Lobby, and an interesting component of the Hobby Lobby ruling was the fact that Hobby Lobby as a corporation was able to claim that certain pharmaceuticals were abortifacients when in fact they were not. And it didn't matter that scientifically these weren't abortifacients. What mattered was that they believed them to be so. So that, I think, places an even higher burden on the state to establish as scientific absolutes that life begins at conception and that the fetus is an individual and unique human being in such a way that would nullify our perception that that's not the case. And I think with those kinds of real real broad rulings in favor of religious liberty in the past, the door has really been open for us to make these claims and to expect that they're not overly challenged or overly scrutinized in such a way that that the Christian religious claims have not been.
There's so many directions I want to go with respect to that. One of the things that Supreme Court jurisprudence, where they have drawn a line throughout history, that I think is a really difficult, if not untenable, line to maintain, stems from conscientious objector cases, particularly in the Vietnam War. And the Supreme Court drew a distinction between what they called philosophical beliefs by individuals who were not members of an organized religion, but who were avowed pacifists or who had other reasons for objecting to service in the Vietnam War. And by and large, those claims got denied. Those people were subject to, at the time, a mandatory draft and had to serve. Whereas if you were a member of a religious organization, the Quakers and the like, that were demonstrably pacifist, that was the grounds for religious exemption to compulsory selective service. And so extending from that has been this sort of uneasy line of, when does a thought become a philosophical thought versus a religious thought? And as I hear you sort of go through all of those weighty questions and think about, you know, where does life begin? Does it require sensation, or does it require higher cognitive brain functions? Does it require more than just, you know, pain stimulus? My first reaction, I think, is, to me, those are philosophical thoughts, right? Where do you draw that line, or do you think that distinction is no longer tenable in light of Hobby Lobby?
I don't think it's very tenable, and I think they were dealing with something very difficult when it came to the conscientious objectors who didn't want to serve in the military, and trying to determine a way in which they could decide who was doing that out of self-preservation, personal interest, and who was compelled by some set of group ethics, whether or not that's even a useful distinction to make when you're talking about deeply held beliefs is questionable, but the government really had an interest in not diminishing their access to compelled armed forces at the time. So, you know, that's a very kind of difficult thing to deal with. But I think when you're talking about religious claims, claims involving religious exemption, I think we have to consider what the spirit of allowing exemption for religious claims is at all, and not get too hung up on the details of what constitutes a proper religion. I think it would be well out of line in the spirit of American pluralism to preference supernaturalism and say that just because you believe in a higher power compelling you to do one thing or another, that your deeply held beliefs are more deeply held or more worthy of protection than anybody else's. Obviously, we're acting on behalf of our own deeply held beliefs and interests. I mean, this is a cause we truly do stand behind. And I know people think a lot of times that what we're doing is a big joke and a good time, but there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that go into this, and that we're not getting pro bono legal support. We're throwing in heavy on legal bills that are difficult to keep up with, and we're crowdfunding for a lot of what we do. And it's certainly an uphill battle, whatever we do. And so for anybody to claim that our attachment to these beliefs is somehow diminished in any way, I think it is a real abuse of religious exemption, of interpretation of religious exemption, just to try to give somebody else exclusive privilege. I mean, like I said, you have to look at the spirit of what this is supposed to do. And I think when you're being asked by the state, when you're being compelled by the state to do something that's really against your conscience, and something that if you're made to concede upon, really has an effect on your own sense of personal and cultural identity, you should have some recourse to argue that kind of thing in court. And I think that's what religious exemption is good for. If you go back to the early writings of Jefferson, it was really quite clear that when he was talking about religious freedom, that he was also talking about the rights of non-believers, infidels, and people of any religious persuasion. He used the term religious opinion. And I think that's really where we should fall on this issue. I know a lot of people feel that what we do, we only do as a matter of tactic, and that if it weren't for these legal battles or whatever else, we would have no need to identify with Satanism. It turns out that's not true either. You know, I think we would still have our community and our values if the Supreme Court were to hand down a hard ruling on what is going to be a recognized religion, what isn't, and it excluded us. And then people would have to decide what exactly these Satanists are anyways, and we would still be who we are and generally doing what we're doing outside of the legal battles. So I think the court's reticence to confront what is truly a religion and who gets to claim religious exemption is actually quite proper philosophically. And I think that position of taking religious claims seriously at their face value when somebody says they're a religion is really the most appropriate way to go about these things. Because even when it comes to openly satirical cases, like people in the Flying Spaghetti Monster Church or whatever else,
right?
That's not to say that what they're fighting for and these values that they're expressing aren't genuinely deeply held. And if they're not, why would they be engaged in it to begin with? And I think their claims can be taken seriously, even if some of their arguments are meant in jest.
So I want to ask, and I don't know if you want to, if Lucian, you can answer this, that'd be great. Or if Andrew needs to answer it, because it's more of a legally question, but what is the best case scenario here? Like, because from my perspective, you know, as an atheist, someone with no beliefs, I would want the result of this case to be someone realizes this is a really stupid idea to give people Christian propaganda and just get rid of that whole thing. But is the best case still just you can file for some sort of religious exemption to the Christian propaganda, but it will still happen if you don't do that? Is that just to pin down the details of this particular case?
Well, I'm sorry, let me clarify something that it might not be readily apparent, but we openly identify as non-theistic Satanists. Right. We don't believe in a literal Satan. And this is another component to the overall battle we're fighting for, this kind of recognition of non-theistic religious points of view.
I understand. I didn't mean to say you weren't, but I just meant like procedurally and how this case is being argued and all that is still the best case scenario that we would, like anyone, whether they're atheist or satanic or whatever they are, would have to file some sort of objection to this practice, or would this case be able to show, or are you arguing that they need to stop with this whole propaganda thing to begin with and not just stop it when someone files some sort of objection to it?
Well, first and foremost, we're looking out for our own. And we do get messages from people saying, well, how does this help the rest of us? I don't want to join the Satanic Temple. And honestly, I just tell them, well, that's on you. You know, we're showing a way, though. And I think, you know, if we prevail, it might not help people outside of the Satanic Temple immediately. But like I said, it does show the way. And also, I think it's got to be very demoralizing for the theocrats on the Christian right, who have this feeling that any strengthening of religious exemption is meant only for them, that there's only one religion that can take advantage of these types of things. And I think the way forward becomes obvious for every other type of group that disputes these things. And hopefully, I would hope that in the future, this makes lawmakers a bit more skeptical of these things to begin with and brings up the questions up front about the philosophical basis of some of these anti-abortion laws and if they can be challenged in similar ways to the way the Satanic Temple is challenging them now. Right now, they're trying to argue that there's nothing explicitly religious about their informed consent materials, but we know that's bullshit. We know exactly where it comes from. We've had these disingenuous questions put forward by the defense in this case about, well, whose religion are we talking about? This was put together by a body of lawmakers. Well, it was directly sponsored by openly evangelical Christian lawmakers as well. And to try to deny that at this point is a little bit ludicrous. And I think the more we fight on and the more other people fight similar battles, the more facile such arguments against our position are apparently, and the less hopefully we'll see of this kind of restrictive legislation coming into play.
Yeah. And there are two things that immediately come to mind here. The first is, Lucian, I thought you made a really, really good point with respect to the deeply held sincerity of the beliefs that you and other members of the Satanic Temple hold. I think it is tempting in when you look at sort of media coverage to say, oh, you know, well, look, this is a parody religion. This is a stunt. This is, you know, whatever. And, you know, we could drill down on the iconography and some of the other things. But I think it is worth pointing out that the state in its opposition brief does not raise the argument that RFRA doesn't apply here because these are not sincerely held religious beliefs. I think there was a question.
Well,
to that
think about it a little deeper, though. Think about the downward spiral you jump into when you start posing those kinds of questions. Again, look at Hobby Lobby. Who asked Hobby Lobby how often Hobby Lobby goes to church or how literally they interpret the Bible? People look at the fact that we're non-theistic Satanists and they say, well, then clearly you're not Satanist. Well, is that what's really required? Do we really need a literal belief? And are we going to start demanding a certain amount of biblical literalism from Christian claims that come forward hereafter? And I think that's a very difficult terrain to get into. And just think of how ludicrous and backwards it is that initially the Satanic Temple comes in, files a suit like this, and people's knee-jerk reaction is to get all pissed off and say, well, this is insane. Now we have these infant sacrificing Satan worshipers coming in and making a religious claim. Then they find out we're neither Satan worshipers nor are we conducting sacrifices of any type. And then they're outraged, saying that, well, then we're inauthentic, as though you know the court should preference that kind of lunacy over something else. And I think that gets to a kind of different topic where, you know, this kind of, where legal preferencing, you know, begins to preference the absolute deranged and insane. And to me, any type of superstitious thinking is a dysfunctional thought process and shouldn't be encouraged by any legal or social process whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, and you will find, you know, considerable respect for that position here on the show. To me, what overlaps, I think, a lot with what you've just articulated is just how far the Supreme Court went in Hobby Lobby in sort of in multiple ways. Number one, in recognizing a right that throughout our nation's history has inhered in individuals as now being found in corporate persons. And you will sort of look in vain prior to 2014 to find the right of a church to do things, right? That was we've talked a lot about the Supreme Court's recent decision in Trinity Lutheran, which was the repaving the parking lot of a church that wanted to participate in public grants. And again, the Supreme Court has continued with this rhetoric of, in that case, they said a church shouldn't have to choose between being a church and competing for government dollars. And, you know, there was zero outrage from most segments of society of, regardless of whether you consider yourself religious, whether you even consider yourself Christian, to say, hey, wait, like the Bill of Rights, the foundational documents, the concept of protecting freedom of religion and freedom from religion is a concept that belongs to individual people with beliefs and not to corporate institutions, right? Like the Satanic Temple doesn't have rights because it's a a corporate body. You have your individual members have rights, and you get together, presumably because you share a core set of beliefs. I mean, to me, that's, you know, that's the outrage, and you're on, I think, the right side of history. This case, I should point, is not phrased as a collective rights case. It's phrased as the beliefs of Mary Doe. That goes back and answers Thomas's question. There are two components to the lawsuit. The first is for an individual exemption under RFRA, which would only apply to her and to others with a similar set of stated beliefs. And then the second is a declaration that the law itself is unconstitutional as a violation of the First Amendment, of both the free exercise and the Establishment Clauses. I wouldn't ask Lucian to weigh in. I think you would want to maintain the position of you're going to win on both. So I will say I think the RFRA argument is a stronger argument. I'm not
willing to say that I feel that we'll absolutely win. I absolutely feel we have a credible argument. I feel, of course, that we should win; otherwise, wouldn't have pursued this. But that's not to say. I mean, we've been to court before. I don't have any delusions that there's always a just or sensible ruling. In fact, when the case was originally dismissed, the asshole judge had waited over 9 months and decided the case was moot because she couldn't be pregnant anymore.
Right.
And we also had that ludicrous bit of dialogue with in the lower court, where the attorney general then was arguing that if we were to claim exemption from these abortion restrictions, we could only do so by providing the names of affected membership that was going to be affected by this in the future. I don't know. you might have a better legal idea of where they were coming from and what made them make such an asinine, ridiculous claim. But the idea was that for us to have valid standing, we needed to actually have standing from individuals,
members who are planning to accidentally get pregnant or something. Is that what?
Right. I mean, they were setting up an insurmountable standard that was obviously so, and I think also an abuse of what standing is supposed to provide.
Yeah.
So, but every so often, you know, those happen in the courts, and we don't know if a ruling will come in our favor or if we'll have to appeal this higher.
Well, and we covered that way back in August of 2016. It was episodes 7 and 8 of the show. So you date back to the show's first 10 episodes. And you are absolutely, I mean, I want to state unequivocally on the air, you are 100% correct that decision to deny standing on the basis of the petitioner is no longer pregnant is a textbook legal error. Right. I mean, it is the Supreme Court could not be more clear. And in fact, is clear in the context of abortion cases, right? Like that argument was raised in Roe versus Wade and explicitly rejected on grounds that were clear for the previous 100 years in other cases that said, yeah, like we will not allow a change in the specific circumstances for time-sensitive litigation claims to moot out the litigation claims, because then they essentially make them beyond the reach of the law and beyond the reach of the courts. It's obvious that that's a ridiculous argument. And
I feel like we should have been able to demand our legal fees from the judge for failing to answer the question that was posed to him after tens of thousands of dollars of legal fees on our end.
And that would open up, and I mean, we could talk about sort of the difference between the U.S. Judicial system, in which, you know, we have both sides come to the table and pay, versus, the continental European model, which, tends to follow a loser pays model. I share your sympathy and the frustration there, even if I'm not sure I would want that result in every case. I do want to say I am firmly on the side of lawyers getting paid, though. I want to make sure everybody listening to the show knows that.
Oh, don't worry, they're getting paid.
Well, that's my next important question. How do I get a slice of that sweet, sweet Satanic Temple legal budget money? We need to talk about this offline.
Yeah, we certainly do. We're always happy to make the acquaintance of lawyers who, even if they're not willing to be pro bono, are energized over ours, because it's certainly helpful to have somebody who believes in what you're doing and isn't simply getting paid.
Well, I love what you're doing in that. I love what you're doing, period. One of the things that I like is that you are exposing on claims that folks with a Christian background take for granted where the limits of those claims are, right? So, for example, you began the interview by pointing out that the claims in Hobby Lobby that are described as religious claims are at best tertiary claims, right? Like, it involved a material misrepresentation of facts about whether certain contraceptives were abortifacients, which then fed into the belief that abortion is a violation of religious tenets, which then only very loosely can, be traced back to anything that you might think of as, a religious or scriptural authority. And I think it's a really, really good argument to say, hey, if that's the standard, right, if we're saying that you can be three levels out for your religious claims, that's fine, but you should be advised that you're opening up this can of worms, because not everybody shares that same core set of beliefs or tertiary sets of beliefs. And we could talk about some of the other cases, the after school Satan cases.
Satan is a great is a great case where we've really exposed a good deal of hypocrisy. Originally, we worked very directly from Liberty Counsel's own model on getting after school clubs into the, and we use them as kind of like as the model. We like I said, we lifted directly from their materials when we were submitting letters to the school districts that already had good news clubs and things like that. And further, our plan was, in kind of a smart-ass way, where if we got pushback from the school districts, we were going to approach Liberty Council and ask them if they would defend our religious liberty, because they do like to put things in the terminology of religious liberty rather than theocracy. But we didn't even have to reach out to them. The first Washington Post piece that came out about it, Matt Staver from Liberty Counsel was quoted as saying that, yes, the Satanists have a free speech right, and that's all there is to it. 2 days later, however, they put out a press release offering pro bono support to any school district that was trying to keep us out. So, so there you go. And then Judicial Watch, that had fought for a long time to make sure that religious organizations got a free pass on any tax exemption or whatever else, they set up an environment in which nonprofits were being rubber stamped pretty quickly. And then it was Judicial Watch that expressed outrage that our after school Satan club got its exempt status so quickly. And it wasn't even the club itself. It was our nonprofit fundraising arm, Reason Alliance. Was rubber stamped really quickly, but it was rubber stamped really quickly because of the work that conservative groups like Judicial Watch had put into it. And now they're crying, seeing that it's applied to us. If nothing else, we're really showing the hypocrisy in these positions.
No, I think that's exactly right, and it illustrates the false dichotomy and asymmetry, right? That if you partake in fundamentalist Christian literature, culture, movies, the ACLU is the enemy, right? That's why they created, you know, Pat Robertson created the ACLJ to, but virtually every major religious liberty case before the Supreme Court in the latter half of the 20th century in which Christians were a party, the ACLU was counsel to that. I mean, like the flip side of what we laugh about with something like with a group like Liberty Counsel or the Alliance Defending Freedom or Larry Klayman or, you know, some of the other guys, that the flip side absolutely is the case with the ACLU. Right. And that's what I love about the approach is, you know, as lawyers, trying to get people to draw lines and take a position is sort of a key part of how you go about parsing how you analyze a case. And and I think you've illustrated in these cases that, you know, there isn't a good way to put a line that puts putting up the Ten Commandments in a public park on one side of the line and putting up a statue of Baphomet on the other side of the line, right? Like it doesn't divide out that that neatly there.
Right. And you know what's funny is we're very much the minority and very much an underdog in all that we're doing. It's hilarious how often we're called the bullies in this situation. We've had some of our chapters apply to give invocations before city council meetings where they're supposed to be open to any invocation, but usually only have a Christian prayer being delivered. And it's appalling how many times it's said that we're merely trying to censor religious voices and therefore we shouldn't be allowed to speak. Or when we have an organization like Liberty Counsel, which is probably worth some millions annually, claiming that we're bullying around these other evangelical organizations when, you know, we're the ones receiving the death threats. We're the ones throwing in a lot of our personal funds and not making it back and doing the best we can to crowdfund and fund our legal bills through merchandise sales. We don't have the kind of benefactors they have. So it is funny that we can be perceived that way. But I think it just says something about how well grounded our legal arguments really are. We couldn't even be perceived as such bullies if we weren't making a strong case, and it's not a strong case built upon financing or any of the other amenities that some of these groups we're fighting against have.
So, in addition to what I would call pursuing impact litigation, right, like the Doe versus Greitens case in Missouri. Do you engage in lobbying at the state, local, or federal level?
Well, we want to start engaging in that a lot more. And you mentioned model legislation earlier, and we've been tracking some of the organizations that that produce model legislation. And sometimes, you know, there's obvious model legislation. We're not sure where it's been generated from. The Ten Commandments model legislation that we fought against in both Oklahoma and Arkansas. I'm not sure where it originated from, but it's obviously the same bill. And we're looking at those kinds of tactics, and we want to start doing much of the same thing, you know. And in some cases, that doesn't have to be attached to the name of the Satanic Temple, which in some cases can be toxic. But we have enough allies now where we can start working very seriously on things behind the scenes and trying to introduce model legislation nationwide, you know, through different entities or whatever else. We really are becoming that insidious satanic network that the conspiracists feared throughout the 80s and the 90s.
All right. So if we have listeners who are sitting there thinking, okay, I'm not down for the goat blood drinking and the baby sacrifice, what's your 30-second pitch for why they should consider the Satanic Temple?
Because we get shit done, and we're never going to stop getting things done. I've gotten a very kind of jaded when it comes to a lot of other activist organizations that they come to love the status quo. And they love the fight for the fundraising opportunities that they create. But you can always count on us to get down to the the bottom dollar and run into the negative just to make sure that we fight the fight as hard as we possibly can and fight it in a way to actually win. We will do everything to do that. You have some people here in the Satanic Temple who have dedicated everything they have and everything they are to what we're doing, and we're really not going to stop.
Well, that's really cool. And if people want to support you, find the Satanic Temple online and stuff, where should you point them to?
TheSatanicTemple.com, and follow us on Facebook for updates on news. On Twitter, it's at Satanic Psalms. And you can follow me on Twitter as well, at Lucian Greaves, since Twitter unbanned me. Also, buying merchandise helps to fund our campaigns as well. So if you go to Shop Satan and pick up some Satan swag, you can know that the funds we generate from that also go towards these campaigns that we're waging against the theocrats.
That's awesome. You're doing the Lord's work. No, you're undoing the Lord's work, one or the other. And thanks so much for coming on the show and breaking down and explaining a lot of what you're doing. I like that attitude that you are just trying to get stuff done, just going to try to fight the theocrats. It's really cool.
Great. Thank you so much. And anytime you want to check in with me, just let me know.
Yeah, absolutely. And seriously, thanks for coming on the show.
And now it is time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. Go be a part of the fun there, by the way. Go check out the extra stuff. It's really good. And on that note, let's thank our new patrons this week. Brian Segovia, Brian Caffrey, lots of Brians, a number of, if you're a Brian, join up. It's all the Brians are joining up. Kuiperbelt Transport.Space, Josh Beach, Aaron Segev, Laurel Griffith, and Emily Gallus.
Yeah, and thank you to Jop, Zach Briggs, Emily Robinson. So, hey, also a good week for Emily. So if you're an Emily, sign up. Tampa Dad 1966 and Lisa Blackburn. Thank you all so much for supporting the show over at patreon.com/law. We will continue to give away all kinds of great stuff to our patrons. I don't think anybody has ever regretted being a patron of the show.
So, no, never happened. Give it a try. We would have heard about it.
Yeah.
Claims about patrons regretting being patrons, not guaranteed. No.
are fully so, guaranteed. I think we should stand behind that.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right. Well, it is now time to find out how poorly Lucian and I did on the bar exam question. This was a tricky one, and it seems to have required some sort of legal knowledge, which we don't have. So let's find out the answer to this week's bar question.
Yeah, so this week's bar question involved Schnauzer, who supplies dog food, selling 800 bags at $20 a piece to Chow, owner of a pet store, who bought the dog food. And Chow received partial delivery of 100 bags, paid for it, but then said, you know, $20 per bag is too high. I will not take the other 700 bags, signed off, and then filed to invalidate the contract under the statute of frauds. How should the court rule on this issue? So first, what's the statute of frauds? The statute of frauds is a principle in the law that specifies when contracts have to be in writing. So one of the things we've talked about on the show is the line of when magic words in the law start to show up, right? So many oral contracts are enforceable. The way in which we know whether a contract has to be written is whether the contract meets one of three criteria. And all lawyers have to memorize this coming out of law school. And it's just, I don't know the reasons for it, but here are the three things you have to memorize, which our lawyers playing along will be able to recite back from their 1-0 years. If the contract cannot be performed within 1 year, and let me be very, very clear about on that, if the contract might or might not, right, if it's renovate a building, that's not a contract that can't be performed in 1 year. but if it is 2 years from now, I will deliver over the next 24 months, the following installments, that has to be reduced to writing. Contracts for the sale of real property, that is land, must be in writing. And this overlap uniform commercial code, any contract for the sale of goods valued at $500 or more.
Ooh.
Well,
that seems key.
Yep. So here, the statute of frauds definitely applies. We have the sale of $16,000 worth of goods. And now the question, this is a very, very typical bar exam kind of thing. So now the question is, whether this sort of goofball memo repudiation is a sufficient recordation to satisfy the requirement of the statute of frauds. And the answer is, because it specifies the terms, right? It says, right, no real person would write, $20 per bag is too high. I hereby repudiate and am not going to accept delivery of the other 700 bags, signed me, right? Like, but the bar exam question goes through that to test you, to make sure you know all of the elements that go into a writing that satisfy the statute of frauds. So this satisfies that. That means that Thomas's second chance bar exam is still going strong. The court is going to rule in favor of Schnauzer and against Chow. But the best grounds.
Let me get this straight. Oh, the reason that we were so confused is that they're saying the note that he wrote back.
Yes.
After an oral deal.
Yep.
Is enough of documentation of the deal.
Yes. Absolutely correct.
Oh my gosh.
And the reason there, yeah, no, I know. And the reason there is because it's signed by the party against whom you are looking to enforce the deal, right? So you've got Chow's signature and he reiterates all the major terms of the contract. So a court's going to say.
So like he could have just not done anything. Like he could have just turned down the food and with no explanation. And that would have been better for him.
That would have been better for him under breach of contract.
Yeah, this is a trick question that a non-lawyer is never going to get right. Yep. Sorry.
Yep. So
well, no wonder I hated this question. I just didn't understand the phrasing of like, how is the note? I was like, the statute of frauds must apply to a contract. I didn't understand that a note written about an oral agreement can turn into a contract. That's crazy.
Yep. Because right, well. Signed by the party against whom it is to be enforced, specifies the term, says I agree to it. That's a valid written contract.
All right, bar exam, you got me.
So no correct idea. Answer A. D is the second best answer, right? It's so you guys got the right result, but for the wrong reason. That's good for half credit in Thomas's second chance law firm. So I think we might have our first, Thomas, you might have your first associate in the law firm.
yeah, we're going to start our own law firm where we just kind of guess and get it like half right. Sound good, Lucian?
People think I'm a lawyer already, so I'm just proving right now that I'm not.
Yeah.
We have, as Thomas will tell you, we have lawyers on the show all the time. We make them run this gantlet.
I don't think they've ever gotten one right, or am I crazy?
You may be correct. It's
we've had three or four at least lawyers attempt to answer the bar question with me, and I don't believe they've ever gotten it right.
Yep.
I might be a lawyer after company. All.
There you go. Yeah. Furnishes those credentials.
I'm well on my way.
Thanks for playing along, Lucian. It's been a lot of fun chatting with you today. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And I am going to hop into my time machine, go into the future, and insert our winner.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, I think you can take some solace from the fact that, as far as I can tell, none of our listeners got this question right either. A bunch of listeners analyzed the question properly from the statute of frauds perspective, but then proceeded to guess C because they weren't thinking about whether the note actually incorporated the necessary elements and was signed by Chow and therefore valid as against Chow. That included, I think the best wrong answer on that was Andrew Drake. But our winner is going to be friend of the show and I believe previous winner, Ilan Wall, who is at ILANWOLL on Twitter, who writes, I don't understand what the statue of frogs has to do with the law, but if there's one thing that satisfies non-statue frogs, it's bees, so bee. Delightfully insane, completely nonsensical, completely wrong, but of our wrong answers, the one that made me laugh the most. So, Alon, you are this week's TTTBE winner, and everyone should feel pretty good about being in the same boat together.
All right, well, that's it for today's show. Thanks again to Lucian Greaves for not making me look bad on the bar, most of all, but then second most of all for the interesting interview on the Satanic Temple. And I guess we'll have to see everybody for another Rapid Response Friday.
Yeah, maybe, may or may not be at lightning speed.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.